Thank you very much. So our next agenda item is discussion on IRP. And we still have two very important topics before lunch, and we're running a little bit late on schedule. So let's try to keep this as concise and constructive as possible. And since we will be reviewing IRP at this stage, we have invited Becky as our rapporteur for this. And things that we should be looking at on this session have to do with the selection process, have to do with the independence of the IRP, have to do with regards to maybe international arbitration. Are we going to go with that? Are we going to choose some other path to follow? We need to maybe speak about the U.S. government proposal on experimental phase, maybe escalating the IRP through different paths. So with that, I will turn to Becky so she can lead us through the discussion in this item. Becky?
Thank you very much. Could we bring up the independent review document? So first of all, just to summarize the comments on the IRP, there was generally very strong support for an enhanced IRP. I think that there was a lot of support for many of the issues. I don't know if anybody can, hopefully everybody can read that on their screen. I've highlighted some of the issues where we heard more comments rather than another. So rather than spending a lot of time on the details, what I want to do is focus on a couple of things. So first of all, we heard from many people, and I think in quite a compelling way, that the international arbitration model was not a very good or close model for ICANN, and that we really wanted something that was more focused on a more closely analogous to a constitutional court that was focused on determining whether or not ICANN had acted or failed to act in a manner that was consistent with the bylaws provisions and that kind of inquiry should be conducted by a specialized constitutional court as opposed to a kind of commercially oriented court. So the notion here would be to more clearly focus the purpose of the IRP to deal with determining whether ICANN has acted or failed to act in violation of its bylaws, and then hearing claims involving statutory rights of the sole member. So while the initial proposal said that those claims would be excluded from that, to the extent that we want to focus those claims, the statutory claims, and that we are able, permitted by law to do so, to funnel those through the IRP, that is the process that would be available and in place. The question of standing people did not really dispute the findings on that. It would be available to a person or entity materially harmed by action or inaction of bylaws, the community acting through the sole member with respect to those, to both bylaws violations and statutory rights. And the process will provide relief for the demonstrated likelihood of harm. So in other words, the harm will not have to be in the past. It could be harm that was subject to an interlocutory decision. Another thing that we heard a lot about was the selection process. Many people were concerned that, that it was inappropriate to look to arbitral bodies to provide candidates, given the sort of mismatch between the arbitral model and what we were looking for, and there was also concern about the level of board involvement. So what we propose is to tender a process for an organization that would provide administrative court, certainly administrative support for helping us set up the court, depending on the preferences, administrative support for operating the IRP. So calling for expressions of interest, soliciting applications from well-qualified candidates, and I want to stress that in furtherance of the diversity requirement, what we would be talking about is affirmatively reaching out to well-qualified candidates and soliciting their application. The community would select a proposed panel through a process designated I have here through the CCWDG, but I mean through the community forum mechanism. One of the questions that the ICANN board itself had was, how are you going to make sure 7 members are not overloaded? How are you going to make sure that you have enough members of a standing panel to address the issues as they arise? And so the proposal here is to have a pre-vetted pool of additional or alternative panelists. In each case, the notion would be that we would have at least one member of the standing panel on all, but to the extent the workload got too large for a 7-member panel, we would have the ability to reach out to additional panelists who were familiar to us, who had gone through training on ICANN and the DNS and the like. And then the board would confirm or reject the candidates. Expertise, again, is it is pretty much as it is, although a number of people pointed out that the expertise needed that was available needed to be broader than just technical expertise, that there might be issues where diplomatic or regulatory or other experts were called on. Another issue that we heard a lot about was diversity, one of the things that I want to raise and discuss today was the proposal was for sort of aspirational diversity, as much reasonable efforts to create diversity. Some people suggested that we should have minimums or caps, so a cap, for example, of no more than 2 panelists from any particular region. And so that's something I definitely want to hear from folks about. Size, we've talked about. The 7-member panel seems to be something that's supported, but that we would have this available pre-vetted pool of alternates and additional members, and that individual panels of 3 decision makers that would be appealable to the full panel. On independence, that's another issue that we heard a fair amount about. I think that the requirements that we stated are a good plus. Some explicit funding obligations related to that. Another issue that we heard a lot on is that there's concern about people gaming the process, not participating in a policy development process. So how we get around that is something we would need to address. There's strong support for as much constructive engagement and an alternative dispute resolution designed to avoid the need to resort to the IRP. Ooh, what's going on?
Adam,
what are you doing? the decision would be essentially that an action or inaction is not consistent with the bylaws, and then substantive decisions on statutory rights. It would be then for the board to determine how to act on a decision that it was or was not consistent with the bylaws. It is not. There's no monetary damages award or prescribed behavior or anything like that. The strong support continues to be, although I have heard some cautionary tales on this, that the decision be binding to the extent that that is possible. There are some limits on that. And I think that's an area that we need to understand more. So that's sort of the substance. Now let me just talk about the sort of procedural issues. There are a lot of very complicated and important details that have to be worked out. So nobody is proposing that this is a final, fully baked, fully cooked, here's how the court will work. And there's a fair amount of expertise that is needed to put together the rules and operating procedures. So the notion would be that a subgroup of the CCWG would continue, assisted by counsel, and I also mean, when I say the CCWG, with the participation of ICANN counsel in this, continue to work on the implementation details and then also work with the initial panel on the rules of procedure, et cetera, as part of work stream two. So the notion is that this is not something that is going to happen instantly. It is going to be something that needs to be put in place carefully and with iterative considerations about the detailed rules of the community. In the meantime, I think that the proposal would be that we adopt the standard by which the existing panel operates, which is that it would determine whether ICANN has acted or failed to act in violation of the bylaws, and that would be a substantive, not a merely procedural rule. That the bylaws would provide for the other aspects of this as they become nailed down and following additional consultation and input from the community. So this is very much a workstream one, workstream two exercise here to get the sort of minimum amount that we need and to really focus, have a focused and a detailed effort as part of work stream two to get the panel up and running. So that's my summary. I see Chris's hand.
Thank you, Becky. Just a specific question on that suddenly got very big. Adam, I've lost scroll control.
Adam's trying to make us seasick.
Adam is trying to drive me insane, basically. Okay, thank you, Adam. Under expertise, So I heard you say that, and I agree with you, that the arbitrational is not the way to go. And are we anticipating, however, that as part of the expertise package, we will be going to people who have experience of, and I'm just going to use this term loosely, sitting in judgment on things? It's one thing to say I'm an expert lawyer. That doesn't mean I can necessarily write a finding that is understandable to other people and complies with the mores that one would normally expect. So I'm assuming that we are, even though we're saying we don't want to go to arbitrational type things, we are looking for people with expertise as sitting as independent assessors or arbitrators or stuff like that,
and I
which
think
isn't
that
here.
Yes, it's not there and it should be.
Right. Okay, good. Thanks. And can I just ask another question just on your last bit? So what you're saying is, I understand about moving stuff into Workstream 2 because of the amount of detail that needs to be done, and et cetera, et cetera. What are the changes that would need to be made to the bylaws now in order, while we wait for Workstream 2 to finish, or not? I wasn't clear.
Well, I would propose, and I believe that there is substantive support for moving to the proposed scope of decision-making, which is a substantive review as opposed to just a review on the procedure. So it's essentially returning to the standard that we had prior to the April 2013 change.
Understood. And then, therefore, the new stuff that we currently have, like the standing panel, would be suspended while Workstream 2 is doing its job. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Thanks.
Robin?
Thank you. This is really encouraging, this work on the IRP. So thanks a lot, Becky. I have a question about the scope of the IRP, and I see it says that it's for people to bring actions with respect to alleged violations of the bylaws, and I just wanted to confirm or get some clarification that it would also apply to alleged violations of established ICANN policies. Is that right?
Well, I think that it's inherent in the bylaws that ICANN has to apply its policies. So we're not creating a blanket, any little policy kind of thing, but any violation that is inconsistent with the requirements in the bylaws would certainly be covered.
So if I could just ask a follow-up question then. So, for example, some of the things some actions that could be brought under the new GTLD program, maybe they didn't have to do with the bylaws per se, but had to do with the applicant guidebook or the way things were handled. Would that then fit under here, or would you have to be able to tie it back to the bylaws?
ICANN has, under the commitments and core values, an obligation to apply documented policies equitably and without discrimination and to follow its rules. So it depends a little bit, because I think maybe there are some things that are, minor issues, but a substantive failure to follow a policy in a way that discriminates, for example, would clearly be reviewable. Leon?
Thanks, Becky. We have a couple of questions in the chat box, one from Rinalia, another one from Izumi. The one from Rinalia, it's referred to exhaustion. She asks if you could elaborate on exhaustion and who does the requirement apply to?
So it depends a little bit on what the nature of the complaint is. So somebody who's just taken by surprise by an application of a policy in a way that was unpredictable wouldn't necessarily have had to, so first of all, there are two kinds of exhaustion. One is you can't sit out a policy development process and sit on the sidelines and wait until the policy goes into effect and then say, wait, full stop, that's that's not okay. The notion would be that to the extent we're talking about policy development processes, particularly if you're a member of the community, you have some obligation to be part of the policy development process and to raise concerns. That's that is an important issue, but it's an issue that requires a lot more thinking and clarifying. Then there's exhaustion about, ombudsman reconsideration, constructive engagement, and mediation issues. I don't think that there's a requirement that anybody has contemplated that there be that you have to go to the ombudsman. There are several folks who have said you should go to or be required to go to reconsideration before. Others have said no, you shouldn't be required to go to reconsideration beforehand. The constructive engagement process has been significantly criticized as a delay, and so in the proposal itself, we included a provision that any party at either time could invoke mediation and go quickly to a mediation provision. And again, all of those details have to be worked out. But the notion is to address, gaming and to avoid people sitting out a discussion in order to bring a case. And then to try to resolve disputes as early as possible and at the lowest level possible without unnecessary delay.
Thank you very much, Becky. I hope that answers Rinaldo's question. Next on the queue, I have Tijani.
Thank you, Leon. Tijani speaking. Larry said, how can you be more comfortable with a few people that you or others selected to have the last say more than the board that you selected and they are from your community? I think this is a valid question. And that's why I say, as you said, Becky, the decision should be binding at a certain level, and we have to define this level in Workstream 1, because it depends on this to accept or not accept it. Second point, the decision of the panel should be appealable.
Should be, pardon me?
Appealable. Third point, and this comes from the last experience with the IRP about Dot Africa, the period of consideration should be fixed and should be definitely fixed. What was said, it was 3 months to 6 months, but the last IRP took 2 years. It was because one of the members passed away, I know. But if the president of a country passes away, I don't think that the affairs of this country will be delayed by as much months as it was. Because when you make it very large, it is rooms of gaming. You have time for everything. So I would like to make it clear that this is a point that must be very clear and well defined in our proposal. Thank you.
So if I can just briefly respond, the period of consideration, those kinds of issues, I think are part of the work stream to defining the procedures and processes, and those will come back to the community. So the notion is it's not you're handing off and the community's done. That will be an iterative process that comes back to the community. Just one other thing. The question on determining what level is binding as a work stream one issue, I think that there's a standard that's articulated about things that are so fundamental to the board. But I also think that there are, you know, that we have heard some questions about making sure we've got it right before, you know, we have full-blown binding decisions, making sure that we've calibrated the what is in and what is out of the what's binding and not binding. So my actual my preference would be that we not close that down as a work stream one issue.
Do you want to react to that, Tieni?
Thank you. Becky, you are proposing a panel. If you don't give those details, if you accept it, and then the details will not be according to what is considered as acceptable, it will be too late to say the panel is not the right way. So I think that since we propose the panel, we have to propose all those details, which are not very granular details. They are essential for the functionalities of the panel.
So just to be clear, we did not get any comments that suggested sort of different levels of bindingness. There was a lot of suggestion that the process needed to be appealable. There were some suggestions that you could have an out so that a supermajority of the board could overrule a decision or elect not to follow it. Those are all very closely tied, it seems to me, with the things that are so fundamental to ICANN's, you know, the corporations and the fiduciary duties and things that, you know, that needs to be calibrated. I think we need to hear from other people, but what I do think we need to do is be mindful of the workstream one, workstream two distinction that says we need to do what needs to be done to ensure that decisions that are made in workstream two can be implemented.
Thanks, Vicky. Next in the queue, I have Alice Munya, and I would like to close the queue at this point with Izumi. I think it's the last on the queue at this point. Yes, Izumi. So we're closing the queue with Izumi, and we'll go now to Alice.
Thank you very much, Becky, for that presentation. We are pleased to note that it has captured many of the concerns we have consistently expressed regarding the current... Okay. Thank you, Becky, for that presentation. We are pleased to note that it has captured many of the concerns we have expressed consistently regarding the current challenges and shortcomings of the current IRP. We strongly support the proposal to move the proposed changes to Workstream 2 to provide not only time for more thinking, but for conducting an assessment of the current shortcomings and providing clarity on how the proposed improvements could alleviate the current challenges and shortcomings. In addition, we propose the U.S. Position on testing the effectiveness of these new proposals before they're implemented into bylaws or made binding. We think that's very important, especially taking into consideration the current IRP. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alice. Any follow-up? No. Okay, so next on the queue I have Rafael Perez-Galindo from Spain.
Thank you, Leon, and thank you, Becky. Much appreciated. I just wanted to commend your work, and all in all, we support this enhanced version of the IRP. Just wanted to make a point about standing, namely that it is stated in the proposal that any person materially affected by an ICANN action or inaction is entitled to initiate an IRP, but even if it is foreseen that interim relief will be available in advance, we feel that the fact that only already materially affected parties have a standing in the IRP could prevent stakeholders from using this mechanism in case that damage or harm has not been produced yet. though, for example, this could prevent governments from filing an IRP in circumstances where an action or inaction by ICANN affects compliance with local laws, for example. So we would like to fill this loophole, and we would propose to expand the scope of legitimacy to file an IRP to a prospectively affected party which demonstrates that severe harm will likely be done to the interests it defends. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rafael. Yes, please do.
That's the intent. It's a loophole in language only, not in intent. That is exactly what is intended to be the standard.
Thanks, Vicky. Next in the queue, I have Asha Hemrajani. Asha? Asha, might you be on mute?
Was that on the mediation? If that was on the mediation, it was a question whether, Becky, you could elaborate on the use of mediation as a form of settlement and how that might happen in practice.
So we would have to set up a process that creates an outreach to mediation to mediators. I don't think that it's necessary to be an internal process, but it would be a process that would be sort of organized and available internally so as to keep it as inexpensive as possible and as streamlined as possible. And the notion really is to prevent endless constructive engagement that is actually not constructive, so that a mediator could get quickly to the point of saying, yes, there can be a resolution, or no, it does not seem like there can be a resolution.
And there was also a comment by Asha that diversity of panelists would help reduce costs. Comment.
I think that's correct.
Thank you for this. We have another question on the chat box by Shino Jadeji, and he wants just to clarify whether the IRP process will be executed by ICANN board, for example, in selection of the 7 members proposed.
So the process for selecting the panelists is very much focused on the community. The community would identify a panel and nominate the panel. And that would be subject to the board's confirmation. There were some calls to say the board should have nothing to do with the selection or confirmation of the panel, but I think the board, the ICANN, is subject to the independent review, and it makes sense that it should be part of the confirmation. It should have the ability to reject members that it feels are biased. But otherwise, the majority of the selection will be undertaken by the community.
Thanks, Vicky. Next in the queue, I have Bruce Tonkin.
Thanks, Leon. Just to clarify one thing on with respect to the current bylaws. So the current bylaws have a provision to form a standing panel. And the board stands ready to form that if that's what the committee wants us to do. My sense from, I guess, what I heard from you, Becky, and maybe others, is that the feeling is right now not to take any action until this group has sort of defined the processes for forming the panel. Is that a fair assumption?
That is what I believe the consensus is.
Thank you. I'll convey that back to the board. The other question I just have is about appeal. So The experience we've had with the new GTLD program is everyone that's lost the decision automatically appeals, basically through the reconsideration process. In your note here, you talk about appeal to the full panel. do you see there's some criteria for appeal, or do you just see it's automatic? You can just go to the full panel if you want to.
No, I think that there will be criteria for appeal. Typically, there are. You have to allege some kind of error in judgment or error in applying the law or error in fact, although it's not usually fact, is it?
So there will be a court appeal process. I think that's important to be clear, because otherwise it just becomes something that's more and more accessible to the rich. You know, it's like, yep, I can afford to do an IRP, and I don't care if I go wrong, I can afford to go to the full panel. So you just end up with a lot of inequity, I think, if there's no constraints on just delaying and delaying and delaying without sort of criteria for each step.
Yeah, so I think that there also need to be provisions for, you know, sort of early action on any appeal that is frivolous, for example, or not substantiated, or and that's all part of the details of the way in which the process operates. And again, let me stress, it's not that we're passing this off and saying, you know, the community will not have a look and input into what those things are.
Thanks, Vicky. I remind everyone that the queue was closed with Izumi, so now I am closing the queue for the second time with Rinalia. And next on the queue, I have Paul Rosenzweig.
Good flexibility, Mr. Chair. Becky, this is great work. I think the IRP is, I think somebody said, the crown jewel of the reform. Somebody said that back in Istanbul. And it's at the core of the answer to a lot of the stress tests is the access to the IRP. So my question really goes to timing, which is I completely understand the idea that we can't write the rules of procedure for this panel before Dublin. And so what needs to be done in Dublin is whatever the limited amount of mandatory bylaw changes and or commitments is necessary. But I'm worried some that it gets pushed off to post-Dublin and we get into a lengthy discussion process with disputes and people not liking this and that, and we're looking at this a year from now without having gotten to the panel actually stood up with a formal set of procedures. What's your view of the timeline, and what's your view of an action forcing mechanism that will guarantee that we're not here a year from now fiddling while Rome is burning?
So, one, I don't think we need to wait to create the subgroup that is focused on this and has the support of experts to start creating the detailed rules. To me, that's very important. And it's an important demonstration that, you know, of a real commitment to the process. Second of all, the bylaws provisions require this to go forward. So the same kind of work stream one, work stream two separation, we need to get in here whatever we need to ensure that this moves forward and gets implemented. And I think there's still some work to be done on exactly what that is. And then third, although if it's just the community dithering, that's one kind of problem. If it's the board not implementing a community recommendation, that's an entirely different kind of matter and one that we can address in the bylaws.
Thanks, Vicky.
Just clarification, how in the bylaws? By setting a firm deadline, or because there won't be an IRP to appeal to require the setup of the IRP. So, what would be the mechanism if the structuring doesn't go forward?
Well, this whole member can bring a requirement, a case to enforce the bylaw provision.
Thanks, Vicky. Next in the queue is Izumi.
Thank you very much, Becky, for your work. And I agree with the categorization of the work stream one, work stream two, and the way forward with this. And I want to comment a little bit on the scope. And so as well as being clear about the scope of what to be included, I think it would be helpful To be clear, in our proposal and the final document for the IRP, to be not what not to be included, what it would be out of scope. For example, the existing arrangement with the numbers community regarding the global policies or the INA functions on the numbering. I think there are other issues related to the CCTLD that would be out of scope for the IRP, and it would be really helpful to have clearly documented and reflected in our proposal as well as the draft for the IRP process.
Yeah, so both of those things were, in fact, articulated in the proposal and will be carried forward. There was no controversy about them at all.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Izumi and Becky. Next on the queue, I have Cavus.
Thank you. Two side questions. What is the relation between IFR and IRP?
I apologize, Cavus. Please repeat your question. It's Matthew's fault.
Excuse me. I didn't hear. I was off.
I'm sorry. I couldn't hear your question.
What is the relation between IANA function review and IPR? How this appear? Would it appear as a subset of IPR? How would be in the bylaws, would be a totally separate course of actions because of its direct relation with naming and part of the transition related to the ICG final proposals? It is first question. Second question, in fact, is once we conclude in IPR, we should come back to the model to see whether it would have some, maybe not, impact on that. And now I'm coming to the question that I have. The question are, one, the number of the panelists. If still there is a provision that one single person decides on the matter, it would be difficult to rely on one single person, no matter how impartial, how competent, how neutral that person could be. Second is the diversity. We should avoid to have panelists from one single country or one single area. They are experts, specialists, familiar in the entire world, and we should implement and we should retain this diversity possibility. Third is the propositions. Who proposed that? It was said that confirmed by ICANN. I have difficulty that we would have established an IRP, to do with actions or inaction by ICANN, and the ICANN select those people or confirm those people. They may propose that the final selection would be by the community. It is very difficult that we have this situation. And the last two questions that I have, what are the criteria based on which an IRP could be invoked? Last question would be, could an IRP be invoked which depends on another IRP in process? And final question is the durations. We have an IRP currently which is in place for years and still no decision has been made. How long an IRP could continue and how community could have any control on that if we see that it has not been duly and timely processed. These are the questions at the IRP, and we would like to have some reflection on that in the document. Thank you.
Okay, I think that the documents will address those questions. Obviously, whatever the ICG dependency is will be fulfilled by this. So if the ICG comes out and suggests we need a new cause of action, we will have to put that in there. But it goes without saying that any ICG dependency would be addressed. I think that the notion that one panelist shouldn't be binding. We may do something that says it's a choice of the parties if they want it to be binding and there's only one panelist, but I agree with that. Diversity, completely agree with you on the diversity issue, and I think that was something we heard loud and clear from all of the community on that, and that will be a priority. On the selection of the panelists themselves, it's actually quite common that that, you know, this notion that you have essentially an executive branch nominating judges and a legislative branch, in this case the community, confirming panelists, that's a fairly common construct. When we went out for the proposal, it actually did suggest that the panelists would be nominated by the community and confirmed by the board. The sense that we got from the community input is that they actually wanted the community to have the final input, the final selection, or that they wanted the community to have more authority. So the notion would be that the community nominates, picks the panel, and the board can reject them, but it can't pick its own substitutes.
Thanks, Vicky.
Select why and how the board could reject that, on what ground? I don't like them. They are not competent. Oh.
I mean, I think that's actually quite typical. There are a lot of cases I know of where judges have been, you know, proposed judges have been rejected because people didn't like them. But I think that the point is, you know, will the board do that? No, the board will say, we believe that this person doesn't have the expertise necessary, or we believe that this person has a conflict of interest or a fixed position or something like that.
Thank you. Follow up by Cavus?
Been said, but not. I don't like this because it's not necessary. Please propose someone else.
Yep. Thank you, Dr. Let's continue the discussion offline. I think that's a valid point, and we should definitely continue the discussion. So next and last, we have Rinalia.
Last. Okay. Thank you, Leon. Becky, I really appreciate your work on the IRP. It's really excellent. I have a simple question on diversity, and I fully support the diversity requirement. If there is a possibility that you're not able to achieve a fully diverse panel, is that likely to delay the formation of the panel itself? And could it start with just a minimal number as opposed to waiting for a full seven?
That's an interesting detail that I hadn't thought of, that maybe you create a panel of five and look for the other two. I think we have to think about that, but no, diversity should not preclude the panel from being formed. On the other hand, I think there's adequate, you know, there's a very diverse pool out there. It's really more of us going out and looking for them and finding them. So I see that as a really, and one of the important pieces of the diversity thing is not just to sit by and wait for applications to come, but have a process in which there is really affirmative outreach to qualified candidates around the globe, and I'm confident that there are many of them.
Thanks, Vicky. So with this, some conclusions I'd like to pose to the group that diversity is definitely important for the formation of the panel. And also in this, we would like to have this be a community-driven process, but in which where the board will also have a saying, and that needs to be very clear. The board will also have a saying in this. Our working group should continue to develop the rules of procedures for this panel, and we should also, I've seen some comments on the chat box about the topics that would be out of scope from the IRP. We should be maybe looking also at which which issues would be falling out of the scope of the IRP. Another conclusion is that we will be looking also at appeals criteria and also trying to avoiding an infinite loop of appeals. So we will be further developing those criteria in this working group. And one thing that I am very pleased to see here is that we do have support for this enhanced IRP version, and this is, I think, a big step forward also for our group. And with this, I think we can go to our next agenda item. And for that, I will turn back to Thomas.
Thank you very much. And I would like to ask Jordan to come to the table. Thanks, Becky, for... So we're now going to discuss the community powers of removing individual directors and recalling the entire board. And there
can we ask the board members to leave the room?
And there is an associated question going along with that, and that's the question of the caretaker board. And the way we are proposing to structure this, the discussion, is that we're going to hear brief overviews from those that have been working on the report and the analysis of public comment. So we're going to hear quick summaries on both powers. Then we're going to have a discussion on those. And if time permits, we will then have a quick presentation about the various options for a caretaker board from Rosemary and Holly, and we will discuss that issue subsequently. So I would like to hand it over to Jordan for introducing the topic to us.
Thanks. And as is the usual style you have now seen from me, the lead drafters will be giving the summary. So Alan will give the summary about removal of individual directors, and Keith Jarzak will join us then to give the summary about the recall of the entire ICANN board. They've got writing instructions of quick summaries. Basically, there are substantive changes here to talk about, but the broad thrust of the feedback was strongly supportive of both powers. So, Alan, over to you.
Thank you very much. There were not a lot of comments on removal of directors, but there were a fair number. The first one that came through universally was the process has to be open, transparent, that there can't be shrouded in secrecy. That didn't translate in with one exception, I think, one common exception, didn't translate to issues of cause, because there was a feeling among many that you didn't want to have a process which could then be appealed. But in general, the process must be conducted in the open and in clear light. There was general support for the concept of removing, of AC and SOs removing the directors supported by them. There were a couple of comments that said the community in the wider sense should do it. There were a couple of comments where it wasn't sure what they meant, whether they were talking about the community in general or the ACSO community in particular that appointed them. It was a little bit fuzzy. There weren't a lot of comments like that. There were a number that did explicitly support the removal directly by whoever appointed them. There was overall support for removing NOMCOM directors. There were mixed opinions on exactly how that should be. And remember, we were talking about a very different reference mechanism at that point than we're talking about now. If you recall the original mechanism that was discussed in Frankfurt, I think, or somewhere, was that the community should be able to remove NOMCOM directors. We realized we were given legal advice very quickly that if in either the designator or member model, if it was the NOMCOM that appointed, it's the NOMCOM that had to remove. So we came up with the concept of a subcommittee of the NOMCOM, and we ended up with three options, basically. Either the NOMCOM itself does it, a subcommittee, or the subcommittee does it, and the subcommittee could be designated in one of a number of different ways. the suggestions that were made were either a NOMCOM, a subcommittee of the NOMCOM made up of past NOMCOM appointees, perhaps the ones that actually did the appointment, if you could still find them. That could mean there were multiple committees if there were multiple people being removed. That was a little bit complex. The other suggestion was to use what was then being called the Community Council, since that is, in fact, the community that wanted them removed to begin with, and simply give them the designated power. That situation has changed now because we're now looking at the single-member model. Next slide. In terms of the ACSO directors, I think it's quite clear the general request was that we follow the model specified in the interim proposal, and that is AC and SOs remove their own directors. And I think that's consistent with what can be done within the current model. I think we heard this morning that although it is the single member that does the removal, somehow that would be done on the instructions from the appropriate ACSO. The NOMCOM appointment is a little bit more confusing, and we need to come up with a closure on that. I'm presuming that it will be the community as a whole that does it, since there were real problems identified with the NOMCOM doing it. Particularly, the NOMCOM normally is covered by sort of a veil of secrecy on the actual deliberations, and that would be counter to the very strong request that this be an open and transparent process. Since we're looking at a community request, I would presume that we will come to closure, but we haven't discussed this at all, obviously, since we're just looking at it since this morning, that it be essentially exercised as the other community powers. That is, it will require a certain threshold of ACs, SOs requesting it, and then a vote at a certain threshold to enact the removal. I'll raise an issue that the report did have, and if you look at the first two sub-bullets of the last major bullet, there were two statements spaced several paragraphs apart, one saying the petition to initiate NOMCOM appointment removal would be from two SOs or ACs or a stakeholder group of the GNSO. A quick poll said no one knew what that meant. We suspect it might have meant a house of the GNSO, which is the entity that appoints the director. Wasn't clear if that was replacing an SO or replacing an AC. And there was a later statement saying it requires a majority of the ACSOs to petition it. So since these are conflicting statements, I think we probably scrap them all and go back to basics and say, what do we want the threshold to be? And essentially evaluate this one like we're evaluating the rest of the community powers, and assign petitioning thresholds and then voting thresholds. And that's about it.
Great. Thanks, Alan. And we're going to go straight on to Keith presenting the other, and then we'll do the discussion. So if you're ready for a hot seat swap. Thanks, Alan.
Sorry, Jordan, if we've got questions of Alan, he needs to stay up there.
We were going to present the two together and then...
Yeah, I was just saying you shouldn't leave together. Here.
Yeah, we just need another chair. You know, sorry, didn't mean to send you away. I did definitely did not. Keith.
Okay, thank you very much, Jordan. And let's make sure we have the right slides up.
We need to swap to the other presentation. Thanks.
So while that's coming up, hello, everyone. Keith Drazik for the transcript. So the next topic will be the community power. It was 5.6 in our proposal, recall of the entire board. And I can start speaking to a review of the public comments while the slides are coming up. There were a total of 28 comments in this section. 25 comments suggested agreement, 3 divergent comments, and 6 comments noted concerns or recommendations. There was broad agreement, 89%, that this power would enhance ICANN accountability, and there was a strong recognition that the still undefined implementation details are critical to ensuring that this community power is both effective and not introducing any unintended consequences. So, flip back here. So, the concerns that were found during the public comment period were the need to establish an appropriately high voting threshold and the two percentages that the CCWG proposal laid out were either 75% or 80%. There was a need to address unintended consequences, the potential risk and instability during the transition of a board that is recalled. The need to carefully develop the process for establishing a caretaker board, and the need to carefully establish the obligations and powers of a caretaker board. Next slide. So the question of how were these issues resolved? And the answer largely is not entirely. We have some work to do. The voting threshold, however, there was a clear preference in the public comment responses for 75%. There were two or three comments that suggested 80%, but the strong support was for 75%. So that will be included as the position or the percentage threshold in our next proposal that goes out for public comment. The issue of risk and instability is still an open issue, and more work is needed. And the questions around a caretaker board is still an open issue. More work is needed. So what are the open issues? Are we reaching a decision in Paris or to be included in the second proposal? And the answer is largely details to be included in the second proposal. Work Party 1 will work now with the legal advisors to craft recommendations addressing implementation details, including addressing concerns with risk and instability, the caretaker board appointment, and the caretaker board obligations and powers. Other points to note and consider are the need to synchronize with the reference model. We anticipated that there would be likely changes coming out of the discussions of these 2 days, so that we will need to ensure that whatever we come up with for this particular power is consistent with the voting mechanisms or the community council or whatever we're going to call it. And then finally, to ensure that we're aware of the CWG transition dependencies in this regard, because this was one of the items that was called out in the CWG transition proposal. And I'll stop there, and then we can take questions. Jordan?
Thanks. And Thomas, do you want to do the queue?
Yes, I'm more than happy to do that. And since there's a queue forming, let me just remind you that we had overwhelming support for these powers. So let's please not go to very fundamental issues. Let's speak to the refinements to the suggestions that we had on the table. So I note that Wolfgang wants to be added to the queue, but first one to speak is Chris, please.
Thank you very much. And I'm not going to speak against it. I'm fine with it. Thanks. Alan, just help me here. We're talking about, in the individual director cases, we're still talking about removal without cause, aren't we? Or have we changed that?
No. There was no mention of cause in the reference doc in the proposal. I believe there was one comment that said it should be for cause.
Right. Okay.
Which in my mind has some follow-on implications, but we're working on the majority at this point.
No problem. There's some things that flow from that. So the first one is on one of your slides it said the SOAC decides. I'm assuming you're talking about just deciding on process, or could the SOAC, could the CCNSO decide that the way it's going to run its process was it could only remove for cause? In other words, how much power are you giving each of the SOs and ACs in this? Are we saying it's without cause, but you can make your own process? Or are we saying you can do whatever you want to do? So I'm not asking for an answer necessarily, just to think about that.
Well, I'll certainly tell you my understanding is the complete process is up to the ACSO, and therefore you could impose
cause.
A cause reason should you choose to.
Okay. And just a couple more points.
have we asked the question, should we ask the question, do we need to be concerned about claims of prejudice or claims of some sort of, you know, you're removing me because I'm a woman, or I'm not a woman, in case anybody's wondering. You're removing me because I come from a... Do we have concerns about that we need to address? No? No? Okay, cool. Good. So that's Holly's answered that question. Thanks.
So just briefly, we have certainly discussed for this meeting, and there was this issue of cause versus no cause. Let me just, you know, before there might be other questions surrounding that. It is our impression as co-chairs and rapporteurs that we deem the board members being representatives of their respective communities. And having said that, it's up to the respective communities how they wish to seat or remove the directors they place on the board. We think it would not be appropriate for us to prescribe how the different groups shall deal with it. And we don't that much like the word no cause. There will be good reason for a group to do that, but there's no legal requirement for us to establish a threshold or cause, and therefore it should be up to the respective groups to determine how they wish to deal with that.
And we're not fussed as a group. I'm just asking a question. We're not fussed as a group about the possibility of capture within any of the SOs and ACs, where you might have a very fine election where there's one or two votes in it, the board member comes onto the board, and then you have this ding-dong where the lobbying has occurred in the SO and AC, voting changes, so suddenly there's a vote, that director gets removed, replaced with another one, then that director goes back into their SO and AC and starts lobbying again, and so on. I'm just asking whether we have any concerns about that.
The general feeling in talking to people seems to be that the threshold for removal should be larger, that generally the threshold for appointment is a majority of whoever it is that's making the decision. Removal decisions, there seems to be a general consensus that it should be a larger amount. Could that still happen? Yes.
Well, my point was simply if you don't mandate that, then you leave it up to each SO and AC. I'm just asking whether we think that's us fulfilling our responsibility, or are we just passing the buck to each SO and AC?
I can't imagine any of our ACSOs not saying that. On the other hand, the director selected by the contracted party's house in the JSO is selected by a relatively small number of people if you look at the councillors alone. And it's a good question. We hadn't discussed it at all. We didn't ask the question. And I guess we need input if we're to specify something.
Closely related issue, Chris. The draft said last time and says this time that where the decision-making bodily either is the SOAC or the NOMCOM, removal requires a 75% level of support. So there's a higher threshold already implied there. The thing that the report is a bit silent about is obviously the appointment processes are set out in the bylaws, so the removal processes should be set out in the bylaws as well. But what that wouldn't include is some kind of standard that the decision
that's
had
the,
to be judged.
That's the question. How far are we going to prescribe for each SO and AC? I think that's what we need to decide. The process itself can just be we'll have public comments, etc. But are we saying you must have a supermajority or whatever? That's our question.
The answer to that one is clearly yes. But that's the only thing that we've said in the draft text that we should prescribe.
But let's maybe settle on keeping this to minimum requirements. Yeah, let's do it as lightweight as we can until we hear differently from you or the community. Let's then move back to the queue. Tijani, please.
Thank you, Thomas. Tijani speaking. Afra Low was the one who spoke about the cause. And I do understand the concern of Alan about an endless appeal process. And to solve that, if we give the power to remove individual members to the community and not to the appointing party, there will not be any necessity for the cause, because the community will not remove any director only because they don't want them or because it is not serving the interest of this particular party. So I made the proposal in this sense, and I do think that there is no barrier to that. I understood from, I don't know who said that, that the appointing party should be the one who removes them, the board member. I don't understand that we can give the power to the community to remove the whole board members and don't have this possibility for one single or some board members. So, for me, the power should be given to the community and not to the appointing party. This will prevent from a lot of problems. Another problem that will be solved by that will be the NOMCOM appointees. Since all the board members will be treated in the same way and they will be removed by the community and not by the appointing party. Second point about recalling the whole board. I was, and Afrado was, supportive, much supportive of the community to be able to remove the whole board. But we can make it one single process. The community can remove one member till 15 members. And when we go to 15, it is the whole board. We make it simpler, minimum change, make things very clear, no way to game anything, etc. Thank you.
Before Jordan answers, let me just say that the queue will be closed after Sam.
Just one clarification. Tijani made reference to why Alan thinks something. Alan does have a personal opinion, but what was written here was the opinion of the subgroup that looked at it and then WP1 in general. So just to be clear.
Thanks, Alan. And on your first point, Tijani, I understand and respect the perspective that you bring about the community making the decision, but the vast majority of the feedback that we've got doesn't agree with you. So that's why the proposal is for the appointing bodies to be the removing bodies.
Was it asked to the community if they wanted to be the appointing body to remove the director? It wasn't there wasn't a question in this sense, so people didn't make other suggestions, if you want.
Well, just relating what we were just talking about, the model was presented and alternatives were obviously possible. You did present one. Others didn't. The feedback, the momentum is not with your suggestion. So that's just the point that we're at.
Okay, Rinalia.
Thank you, Thomas. First of all, to clarify that I speak on my own behalf and not on behalf of the board. I want to highlight the importance of the principle of fairness in dealing with the individuals that are selected to be board members. So when you select a board member, that board member has to be cognizant of his or her responsibility and what could trigger his or her removal. Therefore, cause, articulation of that cause, and the parameter of what could constitute as cause must be present and be visible and acknowledged by the person that is being appointed. So I think articulation of cause, whether it's overall for all board members or for each SOACs, I think that is fundamentally important to the person. The next point I want to make is that I think it is extremely crucial to treat all board directors similarly in terms of thresholds for kicking them out. And the reason is that once they are appointed, they are responsible for the entire organization and the interests of the entire organization that includes the entire community, not just the community that represents them. So I understand that the SOAC that appoints a specific individual director wants to have a say, and that's okay, but I think the threshold must be the same for both NOMCOM and the SOAC-appointed director. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Mathieu speaking. I think you're raising a very good point. There needs to be respect and due process in this in this regard, just like for any other decisions made, and board members serve the community, they're dedicated, they spend a lot of time, and they're owed a certain amount of consideration. And regarding the cause, the one thing we don't have, and I think our group will not be able to provide right now, is a standard about what's expected from the board members in the ICANN community. In a regular corporation, that's pretty standard. There are regulations and laws that say the board member is in charge of strategy and ensuring this and this and this. It's all set up. There's a little bit of that in terms of fiduciary responsibilities for ICANN, but there's also the expectations of the community and how they interact with the board. That was actually pointed out by Larry Strickling in his remarks in Buenos Aires. So I'm all in favor of moving forward to clarifying this with the boards and probably with help of maybe outside counsel with experience in board governance, because that would be helpful. And I know for a fact that there are a lot of standards about this. And making this an item for further work, I think that would be extremely useful for ICANN. But it has to be a joint work, and it wouldn't be realistic to expect this as part of Workstream 1. But I agree with you, there is currently a lack of clarity about this in the community, which might generate a lot of frustration and concerns regarding to the removal. So I think that was one part of the Work Party 3 work program to start discussing this. Hasn't got any traction, but maybe we can still put that on the table for further work down the road to accommodate the concerns that the removal would take place for totally arbitrary reasons and set up a standard that board members could be assessed against.
One brief addition on the second point you raised, Renalia. Yes, the proposal does require the same threshold to be met wherever a director comes from, whoever appoints them, so that at least that decision threshold is exactly the same across all types of director. Keith Drozak wanted to add something as well.
Yeah, thank you, Jordan. Just in light of the conversation, and I know there's still a queue, these two community powers are clearly very important powers and ones that need to be approached very carefully. It's something that we in the Work Party 1 recognize. It was reflected in the public comments that the risk of unintended consequences, as I said, and the potential for instability is something that we need to take very, very consider very carefully. And we will do that. We don't take these powers lightly at all, and we need to make sure that they're approached accordingly. Thanks.
Thanks. Sebastian.
Thank you. I think it's time for me to express my discomfort in all this discussion. Because either you open the discussion without limit, or you say you can't go outside of this rank of discussion, and that's not what I meant for this meeting here. So second, there are things, the comment period, it's not a voting period. Then, sorry, but the percentage of people who say yes or who say no, was not at all a goal of this comment period. If you want a vote, ask for a vote. And I hope that you will have more votes than the comments. The comments, to have more comments in one side or other side, it's quite easy. And then I am not thinking that it's a good way to go. The other point is that the first comment period was to get new ideas. You decide that because your idea put on the first comment was a good one, because more people were saying yes, then we don't need to take care and to integrate or to think about the other proposal, like the one made by Afralo, and I guess some of my proposal too. And my other point is that I am sorry, Thomas, but maybe I am wrong, but when I was board member, never it was told me that I was representing my community who elect me. Never. Then, if you want to change the rule in the middle of the way, you can. But that's not the current situation. It may be what we would like. It may be what we dream. It may be what we want to have. But then we need to change something. And I hope that at least the board member, the current board member, will, or the ex-board member, if they are in the room, will say so, and the legal also are able to say. Then my last point is, as I will disagree, I am disagreeing with the current proposal, I would like to have a minority view, and I put on the table a solution to have not to answer the question you ask about the risk and instability, take care about appointment and so on. And I put a proposal who helped to solve all that issue. I would like very much to have an answer why it's not to be considered. It's in line with what Tijani said. Tijani go to up to 15, I stop to 7, and I explain in my comment why. But I really think that, no, it was not the time to say yes, it was the time to give other possibility, other way to go, and we here need to think about all that. Oh, sorry, the VP1 must have been done that, but if it's not, and I understand that it was not the case, then we need to do it here. Thank you.
Thanks, Sebastian, and let me clarify that I'm cognizant that board members are meant to act in the interest of the community, and the point that I wanted to focus on, and let's not get sidetracked, is that the seating and the removal should be up to the respective communities that delegate board members to the board. With respect to the other points, I think we can't ignore the community's wishes. We reached out to the community to give us guidance, and we've analyzed the comments that we received, and we used to work on the basis of going with the models or the suggestions that get most traction for our consensus call. And I guess that's the way that we're conducting this. This is the agreed approach that we take. And Sebastian, you're certainly more than welcome to file a minority statement if you are displeased with what we're doing. So that's out of question. You can certainly do that. But from a chairing perspective, in our joint goal to find consensus, we have to go with the models that get most support inside this group. Keith, please.
Thank you, Thomas. I'd just like to respond to Sebastian. I was the one who led the effort on the recalling the entire board, which was 5.6 in the proposal. I do recall your proposal that was submitted in the public comment phase for recalling a subset. I think it was 7 of the board members. And it was the only recommendation submitted in this particular section for recalling the entire board. We had 89% support in the public comment response for recalling the entire board. I would acknowledge that your recommendation perhaps could be considered as some variation of perhaps the individual recall and ways to say maybe there's another power that we need or a bridging power that we need, but this particular recommendation, this community power, was recall of the entire board, and it received 89% support. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Cavus, please.
Thank you. From the very beginning, I raised a constitutional issue. When you have board is a aggregate of each member to preserve the public interest in their performing the duty, each board member shall serve not representing their respective community nor any region, but acting as custodian of international public interest or community public interest. It would be a mistake if, as example, GNSO remove a director because in the view of GNSO, that director did not satisfy the requirements foreseen by GNSO, but that director collectively and collegially with other colleagues acted properly in the general interest of public. By allowing the designator to remove the director, you introduce a degree of instability that giving preference to a particular community against the interests of other community. I have no problem that the community invoke the removal of the board, a particular designator, removal of the board, but should be approved by the entire community in order to see that whether collegially that board has performed its duties as foreseen. Directors are not just to preserve the interests of particular community and so on, is to preserve the interests of the entire community. It is unconstitutional and inappropriate. We must do that. We can invoke, but the whole community must approve that to see whether collegially the actions was correct or not. So please kindly, for the last time, listen to what I'm saying, that it would be unconstitutional if you do act. You're breaking the collegial responsibility of the board and you're breaking preservation of the common public interest. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. Jordan?
I understand the two perspectives here, and I think they're being well articulated. One is that I think the underlying concern is that the ability of an appointing body to remove the director that they've appointed risks turning directors into ambassadors of their appointing body, that they will stop paying attention to the global public interest, that they'll stop accepting the fiduciary duties that they have to the whole ICANN organization. The only logic that I can deploy countering that is that it is a very common thing for directors to be able to be removed, and that doesn't change the fiduciary duties that they have. Well, what the existence of a power like this will do is will keep directors more attentive to the needs and desires of their communities. But it is wrong to say that it is unconstitutional to propose this power in the way that it's been done. It is very, very clear in law, in many jurisdictions, not just California, that the default and always acceptable option is that the people who make the appointing decision make the removal. And if we want to build a web of connection that's different to that, then we need to put this whole part of the proposal on the table, and we don't have a mandate to do that. So I think that the power, the way that it's been set out, the consensus that, it's not a consensus, the analysis that has been developed is that this is the right way to do it, supported by the legal analysis. So, co-chairs, I don't know where we go with this discussion, but there is a logic to the current proposal.
Yes, thank you, Jordan. And we will now hear Sam. And as I had indicated earlier, the queue is closed after Sam. We will break for lunch afterwards. And
Wolfgang was on the
queue. You were,
A follow-up question.
Yeah. Caboose, we're already 15 minutes over time.
What is the difficulty that a designator invoke and then going to the committee? Please explain me, what is
Caboose,
the difficulty of that?
Caboose, I was just about to make a suggestion. We're 15 minutes over time. We have numerous individuals that have ignored me closing the queue. I was suggesting a way forward. We're now going to hear Sam, and I apologize for the oversight. We're going to hear Wolfgang. We will break for lunch then, and we will take stock after lunch. We will discuss with the rapporteurs. We will analyze where we are and then suggest a way forward. I think that's the best way. We're all lower energy now. We need food. We need a little bit of fresh air, potentially, and then we will reconvene. Sam, please.
Thanks. This is Sam Eisner. I think what Jordan was just saying, and following on from Caruso's statement and also from Rinalia's statement, there's a tension between what's viable and understood to happen at law versus looking at the effects and the for lack of a better word, political effects on the organization and the potential destabilizing effects on the organization. And so to the extent that the viability of the concept of removal of directors by their appointing entities is put into place within ICANN, that we make sure that we don't destabilize the organization too much by not having some sort of objective standard or community call to it. I think there likely is a way forward to marry the two, but we can't just say because the concept is legally viable and it happens in organizations that we don't look at how it would actually impact ICANN to the larger and external community by not having some sort of standards in how we handle the governance structure of the board.
Thanks, Sam. Wolfgang.
This is Wolfgang Kleinwächter for the record. I'm speaking in my private capacity, and I'm fully support the proposal. I think nobody wants to see ICANN in a situation like FIFA, where it's difficult to get rid of people who have occupied certain positions. However, you know, I want to make one comment, one question, and one proposal. The first comment is, I think we have to have very clear standards and criteria so that you have a clear understanding before you trigger the process for the removal under which condition this could take place. I think this is some work which still has to be done. Number two is a question. Did you consider to enhance the quality of the selection process? I think this is what Strickling said in Buenos Aires. You know, I was chairing the NOMCOM, George was chairing the NOMCOM, CLO was chairing the NOMCOM. In the NOMCOM, we try to send the best people we have under the 100 or so candidates to the board. So that's a process which is confidential. That's why it's not so known in the community. The confidentiality protects the candidate, but at the end of the day, it's the belief of the NOMCOM that they did make a good job to send the best people. So that means to reduce the probability of a removal could include that we, you know, go through the processes of the nomination and to reduce some risk factors. And here comes my proposal. So that means if you get a high job in the U.S. government, you have to go before your final nomination to a hearing, a public hearing. So that means probably this could be help to reduce the risk of a removal. If after we have nominated candidates, before they get the confirmation, they have to go through a public hearing so that the community gets more familiar and has, you know, in the process a certain additional voice. So that it's still a very vague proposal. I know that has a lot of unintended side effects, probably. But, you know, to have a higher quality in the selection process reduces the risk of this unpleasant process of removal. But in basically, I'm in favor of this.
Thanks, Wolfgang. I suggest you continue the conversation over lunch. We will reconvene in 1 hour sharp, and then we will hopefully be able to determine a way forward. Thank you very much.